The leader noted that a criminal group of Zionists kill people, commit crimes in Gaza, and launch attacks on other countries, while the US and Western states openly support the regime in its blatant terrorism. He also emphasized that the Zionist entity is the only true proxy force in the region, which must be uprooted from the Palestinian land. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei warned that if enemies try to stir up seditions inside Iran, or if the US threatens to take action against Iran, they will receive a firm and crushing response, and the great nation of Iran will reciprocate accordingly. For more on this, I am now joined by Hakime Sagaya-Biria, academic and political analyst, joining us from Tehran. Very good to have you on the program. What do you think about the significance of Ayatollah Khamenei's comments today?
Yes, the significance of what Ayatollah Khamenei has noted in his Eid prayer speech is that he's trying to, lead us in looking at the world from a distance, seeing the big picture. You know, sometimes when we look at events around us, we are so much surrounded with the many difficulties that are around us, the many crises and, complexities that are around us, that we do not see the big picture. We do not see the clarity of what needs to be noted. If you look at the world from a distance and you see the big picture, you see that we are at its final stages of colonialism. And the last child of colonialism, which is the Zionist regime, is committing genocide on the part of this colonial system that is reaching its end. And of course, the significance of taking action, appropriate action at this time, is very important to note and to understand the importance and significance of resistance at this juncture of time in world history. Lead us to new realities, would lead the world to go beyond colonialism. And I think the world is ready for that. Of course, the people of the world are ready for that. And seeing this big picture, coming to, being on the same page in terms of the different people around the world, people who are, participating in the resistance against this colonial regime, against this proxy power that is basically committing these atrocities on the part of this colonial system is very important. So I think this is, we are living at a very, a very important juncture in world history, and we can make history with our every step that we take, but the importance of seeing the big picture shouldn't be missed.
Right, Hakime, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution said that Israel commits all of these atrocities on behalf of the colonizers and the collective West. So this means that the US in particular is not just a supporter of Israel, but the mastermind of its crimes. What do you think of that?
I think that is something that many people have been talking about throughout this year and a half, more than a year and a half of genocide. The US government, the US system, is not just a supporter, but is actually the mastermind and the power that is leading, sometimes from behind, but sometimes very clearly, is taking military action against the Palestinian people, by all.
Thank you, Hakim Esaghai-Biri, academic and political analyst, joining us from Tehran. Muslims around the world are celebrating Eid al-Fitr with prayers and gatherings as the holy month of Ramadan comes to a close. In Indonesia, hundreds of people gathered for the Eid prayers in streets and mosques, while in Bangladesh, Muslims filled the National Mosque of Dhaka. In India, thousands prayed at Delhi's Jama Masjid. On Sunday, in Islam's holiest city of Mecca, millions of Muslims participated in mass prayers at the Grand Mosque. In the U.S., Muslims in California marked the occasion with prayers also on Sunday. Thousands of Palestinians gathered at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds for Eid al-Fitr prayers. However, they face a somber holiday amid ongoing war. Residents of the Gaza Strip are observing their second Eid al-Fitr since the start of the U.S.-Israeli genocide on October 7, 2023. Israel presses ahead with its genocidal war on Gaza, killing at least 64 civilians across the besieged territory as Palestinians marked Eid al-Fitr on Sunday. At least 9 civilians were killed in the bombing of a residential apartment in Hamad City, north of Khan Yunus, in south of Gaza. 3 others were killed and several others, mostly children, injured in a strike on a civilian vehicle west of Gaza City. And 2 children were killed by Israeli artillery shelling east of Jabalia, north of Gaza. Also, 5 citizens, including a child and a girl, were killed and many others wounded in the Shajaya neighborhood east of Gaza City. An earlier bombing of a camp for the displaced people in Khan Yunus killed at least 20 Palestinians. The new fatalities increased the number of Palestinians killed since the resumption of Israel's genocide in Gaza on March 18th to over 920. More than 2,050 others, mostly children and women, have been injured. Palestinians mark a rather grim and somber Eid al-Fitr. Streets that were once filled with celebrations are now empty, with families grieving their lost loved ones due to the Israeli regime's genocidal war. Our correspondent Abu Bakr Abed walked through central Gaza, where displaced Palestinians dressed in new clothes demonstrated their steadfastness and hope for an end to the pain and suffering inflicted by the regime.
A very bleak and somber day in Gaza marking the start of Eid al-Fitr. The scenes here in the central part of the Gaza Strip are not the same and the usual ones. Empty streets, closed shops, and grieving families everywhere. And all that reverberated through is just the echoes of the strikes and artillery shells all around the Strip. Nonetheless, people wore new clothes and adorned their despair-filled streets, holding mere demonstrations of delight and steadfastness, and hoping that their suffering will know a very permanent end.
I hope the war will end, and we will spend the Eid as all other people. I wish to go to swings and play, not to be trapped and suffer like this. I was happy here with this initiative. We had some entertaining activities that brought us happiness. I'll also go to my aunt's home like others.
Despite the endlessly lingering consequences of the Israeli genocide in Gaza and the unbearable trauma people have been subjected to during the last 17 months, the Eid comes at a time of grief and unending trauma. The children here in Deir al-Balah, who are internally displaced from their homes, have finally found out the glimmer of peace and joy to vent their pain, and their hope and resilience have never changed. Abu Bakr Abed, Deir al-Balah, Central Gaza, occupied Palestine.
Hamas has vehemently condemned Israel's heinous war crime of killing over a dozen medics after attacking their ambulances in Gaza's Rafah. The movement said a crime which left 6 civil defense personnel and 8 Palestinian Red Crescent paramedics dead represents the largest act of deliberate killing of emergency medical personnel. Hamas said the attack proved that Palestinians are dealing with a criminal, sadistic enemy who is devoid of all human values. It added that the entire world must unequivocally condemn the crimes of the Israeli Prime Minister's fascist regime and hold its criminal leaders accountable for their crimes. The remarks came after Gaza aid workers recovered 14 bodies of the medics killed in Israeli attacks a week ago. The Palestinian Red Crescent also condemned the killing of medics as a war crime punishable under international humanitarian law. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies said the incident represents the single most deadly attack on Red Cross and Red Crescent workers anywhere in the world since 2017. An American surgeon volunteering in Gaza slammed Israeli attacks on Gaza hospitals and the siege on the territory. Dr. Firoz Sidwa, who has treated countless victims of Israeli bombings, told Press TV that Tel Aviv, with the backing of the US and Europe, is deliberately destroying Gaza's healthcare system.
The hospital cannot purchase new material. It can't receive new material. And it's not just humanitarian aid that's not being allowed in. Nothing is being allowed into Gaza. When a person is wounded in battle, and then they are being cared for by a medical professional, the doctor, but also the patient, are protected. So it's a double crime. It just doesn't matter in the Western discourse, in the United States, in Europe. You're not allowed to just say the simple and obvious truth. The Israelis are deliberately destroying a healthcare system with the backing of the United States and Europe. You're not allowed to just say simple things that are obvious to anybody with half a brain can figure it out. You ask a 10-year-old kid to look at the evidence, they'll tell you exactly what's going on. The only way that this can come about is because Palestinians, Arabs in general, but especially Palestinians, are just not seen as human beings. But I also want people to understand that we are committing crimes in Gaza. Everybody, you know, people use the word complicit. They say America is complicit in Israel's crimes, but this isn't correct. That implies that Israel is committing the crimes and we're just in the background or something. The U.S. and Israel are committing crimes in Gaza together. It's American airplanes, it's American helicopters, it's American bombs, even the tanks, these vaunted Merkava tanks. They're basically made in the United States. So I don't accept that my government has to be involved in committing crimes against people who have done us no wrong.
The United States has carried out fresh acts of aggression against Yemen to force the Arab country to stop its support for Palestinians in Gaza. In the latest aggression, American warplanes conducted 13 intense earth strikes on the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. The country's media reported 8 attacks on Sana'a's Al-Malika area and 5 strikes on the Sa'af area. The attacks followed earlier strikes that left 1 civilian dead and 12 wounded in 2 districts of Sana'a. Most of U.S. attacks target civilian buildings in the Yemeni capital. Washington claims the attacks are meant to protect freedom of navigation in nearby waters. Yemen rejects the claim, saying its naval operations solely target Israeli-linked ships in an attempt to stop the regime's genocide in Gaza. The latest U.S. strikes followed Yemen's earlier attacks, which targeted an American aircraft carrier in the Red Sea and Israel's Ben-Gurion Airport near Tel Aviv. The attack on Ben-Gurion Airport triggered air raid sirens in several parts of the occupied territories.
Triumphing for the oppressed Palestinian people and in support of their beloved and struggling resistance, the missile force targeted Ben-Gurion Airport in the occupied region of Jaffa using ballistic missiles. The operation successfully achieved its objective. Through this operation, the Yemeni armed forces confirmed the failure of the American aggression to prevent Yemen from continuing its support operations for the oppressed Palestinian people.
Yahya Sari also reported an attack against U.S. warships led by aircraft carrier USS Harry S. Truman in the Red Sea. The Yemeni armed forces spokesperson emphasized that the American vessels were targeted 3 times in a span of 24 hours. Yahya Sari noted that the operations involved multiple cruise missiles and drones, showcasing Yemen's growing defensive capabilities. The spokesman reiterated that the attacks on U.S. and Israeli targets will not come to an end until the aggression on Gaza stops and the siege of the territory is lifted. The operations come as the U.S. military has been bombing Yemen intensively in recent days. The new Prime Minister of Greenland has once again dismissed U.S. President Donald Trump's comments about taking control of the resource-rich island. In a social media post, Jens Frederik Nielsen said Greenland does not belong to anyone else and the United States will not take control of the island. He stressed that only the people of Greenland decide the territory's future. His remarks came after Trump did not rule out using military force to capture the vast Arctic island. Nielsen's comments also followed U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance's visit to an American military base on the island. Greenland is a self-governing territory of Denmark a NATO ally of the U.S. Trump claims he wants to annex the territory because the U.S. needs it for national security purposes. Greenland's residents and politicians have reacted with anger to his repeated claims, which have been also criticized by Danish leaders. And that is a wrap for this hour's news. Thank you so much for staying with us.
Protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio. For those who seek the truth. The limelight.
Palestinian children are being robbed of their futures, their bodies, their families, their ability to dream, but still they hold on. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for the first part. Middle East Eye wrote, they walk barefoot through the wreckage, children carrying children, small arms wrapped around younger siblings, holding on to what's left of their family. In Gaza, there is no safety, no silence, no pause. There is only one motion, fleeing, bearing, fleeing again. Bombs chase them through the territory. Tanks stalk them in alleys, drones hum overhead, watching, waiting to strike. We've seen their faces. Some are covered in ash, too stunned to cry. Others scream names into the dust, names that no longer answer. Children, entirely alone, wander from one grave to the next. Many no longer even have names, just markers. A number, a label, scrawled in pen on their arm, so that if they die, someone might know who they were. And still, they are hunted. Earlier this month, before the sun rose, nearly 200 children were killed in a coordinated barrage of Israeli regime strikes. This did not happen in combat nor by mistake. They died in homes, in tents, in their sleep, wrapped in blankets, under ceilings that collapse like a second sky. When asked about the massacre, the Zionist regime's ambassador to the UK, Tzipi Hotfli, didn't flinch. There was no apology, no display of sorrow, not even the word children. There was just the standard script about Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, human shields and self-defense. Inside Israel, the framing was even colder. The dead were described as terrorists eliminated. No names or ages were given. According to Israeli journalist Orly Novi, the media has adopted the claim that there are no innocents in Gaza. This language has become routine, mobilized so that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the army can continue to carry out the genocide. It is not a failure of reporting. It is a strategy of concealment. But the world saw, counting one tiny corpse after another. Since October 2023, more than 18,000 children have been killed in Gaza, with many more believed to be still under the rubble. These are not incidents. This is the strategy. Starvation is the second siege. 1 year ago, UNICEF reported that in northern Gaza, around 1 in 3 children under the age of 2 were acutely malnourished, a staggering escalation from previous months. In Khan Yunis, 28% of children were starving, with more than 10% on the edge of death from wasting. Their stomachs swell, their limbs shrink. Hunger claws at them as world leaders debate aid corridors. When sickness comes, there are no hospitals, no medicine, no clean water. Gaza's children are not only bombed, they are starved, infected, and left untreated. According to a Lancet article published last year, there was one toilet for every 220 people and one shower for every 4,500. Disease is the new weapon, with hundreds of thousands of acute respiratory infections and cases of diarrhea in children under 5. Those who survive the bombs and the hunger often lose their limbs. Around 10 children a day undergo amputations. In darkened rooms, without anesthesia, surgeons cut through their flesh by flashlight. Gaza now has the highest number of child amputees per capita in the world. What kind of war produces a generation of children with no legs? What kind of a state wages that war and calls it self-defense? There is a term now in Gaza's hospitals, WCNSF. Wounded child, no surviving family. It's a script on charts. These are the orphans pulled from the rubble, burnt, bloodied, and alone, with no one left to speak their names. While Gaza's children are buried or broken in the occupied West Bank, they are bound and silenced. Each year, between 500 and 700 Palestinian children, some as young as 12, are arrested and prosecuted in the Zionist regime military courts. The most common charge is stone throwing. Many are dragged from their homes at night, blindfolded and zip-tied. They are taken without warning and interrogated without parents or lawyers. They are beaten, threatened, and forced to sign confessions, often in Hebrew, a language they don't understand.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone.
Now imagine enduring over 8 years of daily bombings and artillery attacks on your country, coupled with a crippling siege on your ports, denying the entry of basic supplies to your civilian population, the death, destruction, hunger, displacement, and disease that your people suffer. Now imagine that onslaught no sooner subsides that the same nightmare has just become someone else's fresh debacle. Such is the story of Yemen, a resilient people who resisted a Western-backed campaign behind the Saudis to subjugate Yemen, can be enjoying peace today and working on rebuilding their war-torn nation, but instead, they have chosen to fight for their brethren in Palestine. Yemen's anti-Israel and anti-U.S. operations to bring an end to the genocide in and the siege of the Gaza Strip is the focus of our Spotlight program. And now for our guests. Joining us is Mr. Saad Nimr, Professor of Political Science at Birza University in occupied Ramallah. And Mr. McNapier, co-founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Glasgow, United Kingdom. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess Professor Saad Nimr, we'll start with you. Welcome, sir. Your initial thoughts, how justifiably so the people of Yemen today can say we are beat up, we are hungry, too tired to fight, yet they show nothing but will and fortitude when it comes to Palestine, and in fact have implored and lambasted other Arab and Muslim leaders for not doing their part in supporting Palestinians.
I think that maybe the only people who can feel with us quite well are the Yemenis, because they've been through that in the last, you know, for 8 years of a war, which was launched against them, supported by America, and they make them, you know, suffer a lot. And then they saw the same thing is happening to the Palestinian people, and especially the genocide war against the Palestinians, especially in Gaza. And they felt the same feeling, you know, for the Palestinian. And no one stand with Yemen during that period. And they said, now we should stand by the Palestinians. And that's why they were, you know, out of lots of reasons, Yemenis are committed to help the Palestinians. And through the whole period of the war against Gaza, they were joining, and they joined, and they had an embargo on the Israeli shipments, closing their ports, and closing the Red Sea for sailing, or anyone who's serving Israel as well. And that makes them, you know, feel the same feeling as they felt during the war of 8 years of Saudi Arabia and Emirates who launched it against the Houthis. Now they are doing the same to the Palestinians and helping the Palestinians when no one of the Arab countries had helped them during this war. And that's why they felt, I think that this is the main reason. And also their commitments as Arabs, as Muslims, as also humans who would help the Palestinian. For all these reasons, they were there to help the Palestinian people in Gaza.
Thank you, Professor Nimr. Mr. McNapier, welcome to the conversation, sir. Thank you for your patience. Just moments ago, less than an hour ago, we had breaking news here. A series of 13 intense airstrikes by U.S. warplanes again have targeted the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, following earlier strikes that resulted in at least one dead and five wounded. Mick, obviously Yemen, at a considerable cost to itself, continues to stand militarily against the wholesale slaughter of Palestinian people in this 3-week siege now on the entry of all aid into the besieged Gaza Strip. How do you assess Yemen saying that its stance here is a sense of duty and obligation to stand with the Palestinian people?
It's so clear. It's crisp. It's really good people versus bad people. It's if you were looking at the world from outer space, you would see the genocide taking place in a small place called Palestine, and silence and gloom elsewhere, and active support from some governments. But you would see Yemen. You would see that this was a place where vast numbers of people actually took a practical stand. We know that all over the world, great numbers of people in every country oppose what America is doing. Great majority of people in Britain oppose what America is doing. But we are unable to reach the stage where we can give practical support to the Palestinians facing a genocidal monstrosity. and the Yemenis have taken this action. As Saad Nimr points out, it's the fruit of experience. We're coming up, actually, I just saw, we're coming up to about 10 years anniversary. About 10 years ago, the Saudis commemorated or even celebrated the first stage of their attempts to subjugate Yemen. And in order to celebrate this Prince Walid bin Talal offered all 100 Saudi pilots who were dropping American bombs on Yemen and had been doing so for many years, he offered every single pilot a Bentley car. Now, the revulsion around the world was so great, I don't know if he actually delivered the cars, but it brought into sharp relief the disgusting nature of this extremely wealthy and powerful state, Saudi Arabia, trying to bomb the Yemenis into the ground, and thinking 10 years ago that they had succeeded, reached the end of the first stage. So I think the Americans need to learn from this. The Americans have slaughtered people in country after country. It should be noted, quite successfully, in order to crush opposition and drown it in blood. But when they came to a particular country, Vietnam, they encountered a population which was determined to resist, a people, and with a leadership that was determined to resist. That's the situation in Yemen. It's a very different situation in many ways, but they meet a population who demonstrate in their millions every Friday in support of the challenge to Israel, in support of the challenge to the USA, which clearly enjoys mass support, and a leadership which really seems to be determined to pick up this challenge and come to the aid of the Palestinians. It's genocide. Regimes are silent. Many regimes are supporting the genocide, and the Yemenis are coming out practically in support. This will not be forgotten when the history books are written. And I think the Yemenis approach from a tremendous history of resistance, but they also approach from a knowledge. They're sitting in a very strategic waterway, and they can, if they can absorb the punishment from the Americans, they can deliver a significant blow to the Western economy. And they've proven that already. If they hold their ground, then Trump, by the way, Trump was elected on a platform of ending foreign wars. And now he says that he'll bomb Yemen without any limit of time. This doesn't play well in America. But this is what Trump's trying to do. If the Yemenis can hold on, can continue to resist, there are many strong forces which suggest that they could be successful.
Thank you, Mr. Napier. And Professor Nimr, we know that during the first 15 and a half months leading up to the January 19th implementation of the Gaza ceasefire, Yemenis put a ban on, according to Mr. Napier, the strategic waterways. Any Israeli-linked vessel was not allowed to access those waterways, and it nearly 200-plus vessels were commandeered for trying to get goods into occupied ports of Palestine there. And then next to that, the Yemenis also, they engaged with missiles and drone operations against the occupied ports of Palestine, we know, in support of the Palestinian people. And they said they will stop once the Gaza ceasefire is implemented, and they did. Post-January 19th, we didn't see any more operations from the Yemenis. So we have to ask, when we know that that Gaza ceasefire was so pressing and its implementation so effective and it brought so much tensions to an end, why did the U.S. allow it to fail?
Well, you are absolutely right. I mean, the Yemenis had put a kind of a condition. If you cease fire in Gaza, we will stop our operations against the any vessels who are carrying, whatever goods to Israel military or otherwise through the Red Sea. And they did, because they caused the Israeli really a huge kind of losses, especially when they targeted Eilat port in Rashrash, and also targeted even Tel Aviv with hypersonic rockets. But at the same time, they said if there is a ceasefire and Israel stops this genocide in Gaza, we will stop, because we are supporting the Palestinians, and this is what we are doing. So if you have a ceasefire, we will do it. So when ceasefire goes on, the Yemenis is stopped, and they respected their decision, and they stopped all kind of operations in the Red Sea. And even Israel and the other countries could use the Red Sea and the Arab Sea freely now without any threats. But what happened? Then the Israeli came out and they started this starvation and blocking all the crossings in with Gaza, preventing the Palestinians from food, water, oil, and everything which is related to their daily life. And now for more than a month, a Palestinian now really suffering really a hunger problem. So the Yemeni said, if you don't stop, then we will resume, because this is an act of war. And they just threatened, they didn't do anything yet. Yet the United States, they started bombarding Yemen before Yemeni do anything. It's quite clear that the United States, and especially Trump, his policies in the region, definitely is, as Mick said, it's contrary to what he was elected supposedly for, to talk about, you know, peace, and that he want to bring peace into the area, and he preparing that to resume the Abraham Accords, according to him. But at the same time, he's showing, you know, real problems with the Middle East and supporting Israel and supporting what the Israeli wanted. So he started and resumed bombarding Yemen again, even before Yemen start any kind of only threat to resume the war. And they gave the Israeli 4 days in order to stop this blocking of aid to enter, humanitarian aid to enter to Gaza. I believe that the American have now an idea that they wanted to put, you know, eliminate the Yemenis from doing anything. And they have the, what during Biden administration didn't work. The UK and US, both of them, they bombarded Yemen many times and it didn't work. So Trump thought more power and more, you know, bombardment to Yemen, that will make the problem end. But it's not going to end, and the Yemenis are not going to be defeated.
Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mr. McNapier, when Abdul Malik al-Houthi, leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, said in mid-March he gave Israel an ultimatum, a four-day ultimatum, to lift the siege on Gaza, Israel went and allowed the whole ceasefire at that point to go belly up, as you very well know. But Yemen had not resumed its anti-Israel operations yet when, Professor Nimmer's point, and very accurately so, the U.S. started attacking Yemen. So my question to you, the fact that all this could have been avoided if the U.S. would have pushed the Israelis to respect the ceasefire, one, and two, the fact that the Yemenis are dictating terms to the U.S. and Israel, what does that say about the Yemenis themselves?
It says much for the character and the integrity and the confidence, but also the courage and the understanding of the balance of forces by the Yemeni leadership. The Americans aren't used to being talked to like this. They expect everyone around the world to kowtow, to accept their leadership. But you know, I think this is much deeper than a policy. I think that Israel needs to survive in this area as a murderous regime based on the mass killing of Arabs and Muslims. Israel needs to be surrounded by states which are either devastated, like Syria, Libya, Iraq, or clients supine clients of the empire. Anything else is unacceptable because Israel is extremely vulnerable. We're talking about 6 million Zionist Jews, probably, maybe less, maybe fewer than that, who are prepared to fight, surrounded by 600 million, I think, is one calculation of the number of Arabs. And they can switch on their TV sets and see Arabs being killed because they're Arabs. Muslims around the world can switch on their... They kill Christian Palestinians as well, but they can mainly see Muslims being killed by this Islamophobic regime because they're Palestinian Muslims. How to survive in that area is not easy. You know, if you imagine six people in a room trying to control 600, it's not easy. You have to divide them. You have to make them afraid. You have to terrorize them. It's the same with 7 million and 600 million. So Israel is deeply fragile, and it can only survive in that area as an ethnic cleansing operation by, as I said, devastating those states which refuse to be clients. So I think there's something profound here. Israel wants to continue with the killing, and the price for continuing with the killing is that the Yemenis will come to their aid, and then America has to be called upon to bomb the Yemenis. It's worth pointing out, by the way, that although he huffs and puffs, Netanyahu, when he meets Trump, understands that Trump is the boss. That's clear from recent developments. But it's also clear that the basic idea of Zionism, which sold itself to Britain initially and then to America as an attack dog in the area, a way in which America could avoid becoming entangled because Israel would do the fighting for it. We now see that with the Yemenis coming into the equation, America has to intervene to save Israel, not delegate the role in the whole region of attack dog to Israel. So I think this is a profound crisis for the Zionists. We don't know how this will play out inside Israeli society. Sadnimer's insights into this would be valuable. But I think that as America generally tries to solve its problems by great violence, by aircraft carriers, by B-52 bombs, etc., etc. But they seem to have come up against an enemy here, an opponent, which is different from the rest. Because the majority of people in Egypt, of course, support the Palestinians, but the regime is completely different. What you have is a unity between the people in Yemen and the leadership, and that's very dangerous for the Americans and for the Israelis.
And that's the thing, Professor Nimer, because Abdel Malik al-Houthi, the leader of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement, he's implored other Arab and regional leaders to stand with Yemen and its operations and its stance against the U.S. and Zionist plots, saying that their plans go far beyond the Palestinian people and Palestine, that they are an existential threat to the region and the nations of the region itself.
Well, yes. Let me just remind you with something. When the Yemenis managed to impose this embargo on the Israeli entity generally and prevent the Red Sea delivery of any kind of commercial ships to come to Israel from that side, Israel suffered a lot. What the Arab did, Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and through Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and to Jordan, there was a line of supplies of food and everything which was missing to go to Israel. So Arabs, instead of standing with the Palestinians, to the contrary, they were solving the problems of Israel, which the Yemenis has imposed. So when Abdel Malik al-Houthi is asking all the other Arabs to do at least, you know, the minimum they should do in this case. If you don't want to stand with the Palestinians and to fight Israel, at least don't help Israel. This is something, you know, unbelievable. So his call for the Arab leaders is really because it's shame for those Arab countries, because as Mick said just a minute ago, they are clients to the Israelis and the American also supremacy over the area. Let me just, you know, say at the same time, we are talking about also Egypt and Qatar. Both countries are now, they are accommodating the talks between the Israelis and the Americans and the Palestinians in order to have a ceasefire in Gaza. But at the same time, they are applying pressure on Hamas and the Palestinian resistance rather than applying pressure on Israel. Why they didn't stand up and say, it is Israel who is breaking all these agreements, it's not the Palestinians. But they even they didn't say that, which is the minimum. You've been there and you've been a mediator and you know exactly what's going on. Why at least you didn't just tell the truth of what happened during these negotiations and who break the agreement and who's committed to the agreement? So it's something sometimes, you know, it makes you think of what kind of Arabs and Muslims we are talking about here. So Al-Houthi, when he talked, Abdelmalek Al-Houthi, when he asked Arabs and other countries, you know, to help, at least he would put them in front of their responsibilities, which they are not even doing the minimum that they should do.
And thank you there. And Mr. Napier, let's also touch on Yemen's military advance, its evolution of its arsenal there. When the Saudi-led coalition started attacking Yemen back in March of 2015, I believe Yemen did not have a remarkable drone arsenal. It had pretty crude missiles at the time. Today, it has hypersonic missiles reaching Tel Aviv. It has these super-fast frigates all over the Red Sea. It has multiple types of drones, all homegrown, sophisticated, indigenous-built equipment. In 10 years' time, tell us how remarkable the military advancements for Yemen have been.
Well, I'm far from a military expert, but I do know that it was technological advances which almost allowed the Egyptian soldiers in 73 to inflict a devastating defeat on Israel. Instead, they fought to a draw. It was the technological developments which worked against Israel. I think the same is true here today. The distance between Yemen and Israel is significant, but Israel is very vulnerable with its airports and its advanced infrastructure and its nuclear power stations and so on. Israel's very vulnerable to the missiles that can be fired from Yemen. And the Yemenis have a strong hand. They have been fighting against, it was the Saudis who dropped the American bombs by proxy for so many years. Now the Americans are dropping the bombs themselves. But Israel remains very vulnerable to an attack from Yemen. So I think the balance of power is such that, I think generally speaking, the Palestinians cannot win their freedom by themselves. Despite the amazing achievements of the Palestinian resistance, they cannot defeat America, the EU, Britain, Canada, etc., ranged against them. This needs to be solved at a regional level. And Israel cannot survive for a year without the active complicity of Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and the other regimes which Saad referred to. Without that complicity, they could not carry on the way they are doing. So the genocide can only be carried out with the connivance and the active complicity, as Saad points out. The Yemenis asked permission, I think, a couple of years ago. Would the Saudis allow the Yemenis to march to fight the Israelis? That's all they needed to do, open the borders and let them go to fight. But the Saudis actually actively cooperate with the Israelis against the resistance. That's the sad truth. And until that situation is changed, the Palestinians will always remain in great peril from this genocidal regime and its local backers.
Thank you, Mr. McNapier. And Professor Nimmer, final question to you. We know Donald Trump has threatened Yemen with this hell on earth to pay if they don't stop attacking Israel and Israeli-linked vessels. He really likes that one. He said Hamas in Gaza, hell on earth, hell to pay. Iran, hell to pay, hell on earth. Yemen, hell on earth. But you remember when you mentioned a fire and fury with North Korea in his first term, that got the attention of the North Koreans. Kim Jong-un met with them a couple times. They sat down, they spoke. But the Yemenis seem very unfazed with the U.S. president's threats. Why?
Apparently Trump, first of all, he liked this word, you know, hell on earth, and he used it frequently. But at the same time, there is something he missed. That there are, you know, lots of changes had happened to the region and to the world before, you know, like, you know, I'm not talking about the 60s and the 70s when he could send his troops over any country and defeat this country. Now the whole game is changed, and the way it changed. And after the 7th of October, we have witnessed now something is regional is being changed as well, when Hezbollah and Ansar Allah in Yemen also participated in this war. So he's threatening, but at the same time, he couldn't do anything to Yemen. Threatening Gaza with hell after 15 months of genocide. What he would do more? And Yemen, after 8 years of war, which was supported by American, by the way, what kind of things that he could do more to the Yemenis more than 8 years? So the Yemenis, they do know exactly what the Americans are able to do, and at the same time, they can resist them and they can fight back. At the same time, Yemenis are insisting he didn't know even the psychology of the Yemenis and the culture of the Yemenis. And this is something it's far away from the mind of Trump. He thought that he can threaten anyone and they should comply immediately after his threat. This is something he had to learn, that this is have changed. Neither Hamas or the Houthis will change their mind.
Great input and contributions to the program. Thank you both, and appreciate having you both on. Stay safe. To both the Professor Saad Nimr, they're joining us out of Ramallah, and Mr. Mick Napier, they're joining us out of Glasgow, United Kingdom. That brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله. لا إله إلا الله.
Answering your doubts and questions. And questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
الله هو إذا الرحمن. الله هو إذا المنان.
لا إله إلا الله.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim and Assalamu Alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Ata, the host of this program. Sheikh Ahmad Danish is over here to answer today's question. Assalamu Alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu Alaikum. Thank you.
Okay, Sheikh Ahmad Danish, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the concept of Al-Mi'raj. So what happened during the Mi'raj of Rasulullah? First, let's talk a little bit about the whatness of Mi'raj. What was it exactly and what took place in such an occasion? So what is Mi'raj?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. And so regarding the Mi'raj of the Holy Prophet, and the fact that it happened during the 10th year of the Baisa, or the prophethood of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was still living in Makkah, right? And the 10th year of the prophethood is the time when the persecution of the Quraysh has increased.
Yes.
And their opposition to Islam has increased, and the Hijrah is still about 2 to 3 years away. And so when we see the verse of the Holy Quran, the Holy Quran speaks about this in Surah Al-Isra, the first few verses, and Surah Al-Najm. And this event is narrated in the Holy Quran. And so this is an authentic event, and
yes,
on which almost all the Muslims agree that such an event or ascension of the Holy Prophet happened in such a manner. So the verse of the Holy Quran in Surah Isra says that Subhanallazi asra, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, Subhanallazi asra bi abdihi laylan min al masjid al harami ila al masjid al aqsa allazi barakna hawla. Hawlahu.
Yes.
So it says about, so there are two journeys of the Holy Prophet that happen in the event of the Mi'raj. The first journey is from Masjid al-Haram ila al-Masjid al-Aqsa,
mm-hmm,
that is Bayt al-Muqaddas or Jerusalem,
mm-hmm,
or what we call Jerusalem, Jerusalem,
that's right,
or Bayt al-Muqaddas.
Yes.
So, and it is narrated by Masjid al-Aqsa, that is the mosque that is far away. The Masjid al-Haram is Khan-e-Kaaba or the Holy Kaaba. And from here, the Prophet ascends or is taken by the angels to Masjid al-Aqsa. And from there, his ascension to the heavens starts. So there are two journeys that,
yes,
take place.
Yes.
And in the traditions, it has been narrated that the angel Jibreel appears to the Holy Prophet and says that the night has passed, and he says that we are going to take you on a journey with,
yes,
us. And other angels are also mentioned in this tradition. And so the first stop is at Masjid al-Aqsa in Bayt al-Muqaddas or Jerusalem. And from here, his ascension to the heavens is start. And the last point of the journey is Sidratul Muntaha.
Mm-hmm.
That is the nearest point of meeting with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And it is difficult to picture what sort of realities the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam encountered,
right,
in his journey. But it is said that he crossed the different heavens and reached closest to his Lord,
mm-hmm,
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And there the Lord spoke with the Holy Prophet.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the secrets and the realities were communicated to the Holy Prophet. And this,
right,
this point is called Sidratul Muntaha. And Angel Jibreel, who is the closest or the most renowned of the angels, the most elevated of angels, said that from this point onwards, even if I try to go an inch higher, my wings would be
from
destroyed
fire,
or
that's right,
they will catch fire.
That's right.
And so this was a stature for the Holy Prophet, that even Angel Jibreel could not reach that high status or this position. And so when we try to understand this reality, it is a bit difficult,
that's
for
right,
us to even understand or come close to this reality. But
okay, first of all, let me say that when you say Siddat al-Muntaha, in Ziyarat al-Nahiyat al-Muqaddasa, Imam al-Hussein is called as Ibn Siddat al-Muntaha.
Hmm.
I mean, even on the gates of Imam al-Hussein's holy shrine, it's written, As-salamu alayka, Ibn Siddat al-Muntaha. Okay?